for us, it was, we knew that Wisply had to be global. Yes, it was probably a bit early, so it's an extra layer of work in terms of doing the translation piece, but the system was built to cater for that anyway.
Hey folks, welcome to Business Beyond Borders. I'm Cynthia Dearen. What do you do when you uncover fraud at your workplace? Do you speak up or brush it under the carpet and hope it will go away? That was the question that faced my guest today, Sylvain Mansut. Sylvain is the co-founder and CEO of Wisply, a platform that enables anonymous, trusted conversations at work. Sylvain started the company after he uncovered one of the largest ever cases of corporate fraud in Australia. From his experience as a whistleblower, Sylvain realized that employees needed a better way to report fraud and misconduct. And he created Wisply to help make whistleblowing safe and easy and to provide a platform for organizations to better identify and address risk. A few years on, and Wisply is in markets around the world, especially in places where there's whistleblowing legislation. I'm looking forward to hearing Sylvain's story today. Sylvain, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on Business Beyond Borders.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
Today we're talking about Wisply. And you and I met a couple of months ago, and I will be honest, when I found out that Wisply was a company that facilitated whistleblowing, I was like, whoa, what is that? Where did he get the idea for that? So my first question today for you today is, what's Wisply? You know, what does it do? And what was the catalyst for creating the company?
So Wisply is a platform that enables people to speak up. So some will call it a whistleblowing platform. We actually call it the platform that enables trusted conversations between an employee and an employer, or a student and a school, for instance.
Sylvain, I wanted to ask you about how Wisply works, because it's a bit different to other whistleblowing platforms or mechanisms out there. And I was wondering if you could talk to me specifically about anonymity and how that affects, you know, how people use the platform and how much you can actually trust reports that are made anonymously.
Yeah, sure. So Wisply is pretty much like your, you know, Gmail account, or where when you create your safe inbox, you actually make up the username and password so it doesn't relate to your identity. And then when you're in your safe inbox, you actually don't send an email, but you start a trusted conversation. And for each trusted conversation you start with Wisply, we give you a different avatar. So the first one, you might be the yellow snake, and you talk about, you know, working out at work and being close to the burnout, and you reach out to HR because it's an HR topic, and they'll know you as the yellow snake. And maybe after a few hours or a few days, you'll be happy to give away your name because you know they're going to help you. You're not the only one in that situation. And so they'll know who you are behind the yellow snake. A few weeks later, you might want to report suspicion of theft or something, and you might have a photo or short video or whatever else you may have that you can submit. And you might be the pink lizard something, so a different avatar on that conversation. And because it's suspicion of theft, it might go to the internal audit team of your company. And they can interact with you to verify and validate the information that you've submitted. The third conversation could be an accusation or something around, you know, bullying or sexual harassment, a lot more serious. Again, it goes to HR, and they might know you about, you know, under a third avatar, and they're not going to go and interview, I guess, the manager or whoever has been accused of misconduct. They're going to dialogue with you and show empathy, hoping that you're going to come forward to seek help. So usually those companies will not go and take everything for granted because, of course, you are anonymous. And the idea is to build trust and to create, you know, an environment where the employee or the individual is comfortable in giving away their name. So you might say, yes, there's more likelihood to receive what we call false positive using Wisply. But that ability to have a two-way conversation enables the case managers to actually verify whether this is a valid report or not.
What made you start a company that was a platform for trusted conversations?
So that's a good point. And all started in 2012 when I uncovered a $20.7 million fraud in Australia.
Can you tell us a bit about that without sharing any state secrets?
No, nothing's secret. It's fairly public anyway. But I got a job at a company called Leighton Contractors in 2012, and it was in procurement. And my role was part of a core team of about five of us, and the idea was to see where the money was going so we could optimize the spend of the organization. And by doing that exercise, I stumbled across some interesting invoices, and that led me to find out that the person who was actually creating those invoices was someone quite senior within the company, and that was going on for about 12 years, but he was actually paying himself out of those invoices.
Wow. And so that happened, you uncovered the fraud, but what happened next? Because lots of people uncover a fraud, but that doesn't immediately take them into creating a company that helps people to have trusted conversations. So how did you, tell me the story of how you got there.
So when I saw those invoices, I thought that I had to be wrong. I thought that this couldn't be fraud, and that for sure, I was looking at that from the wrong angle. So it took me a few hours to actually go back to the information that I found on the internet, that I found from accounts payable. And at the end, it was that guy. So it's funny how your brain works. It tries to protect you. So it was one side of my brain was telling me that I had to be wrong, and the other side was telling me this is fraud. And in my mind, I thought, you know what, in our society, we're being raised as, you know, the majority is usually fairly correct and usually right. And in my case, I was the only one in 12 years to see that and thinking of this was wrong. And so I looked at what was available for employees to report wrongdoing or suspicion of wrongdoing. And it took me about 30 minutes to find the code of conduct and whistleblowing policy. And in there, I was lucky enough that my company subscribed to a so-called independent third party offering all range of reporting mechanisms, from the hotline to the fax, the PO box, the email address, and the form on the internet. And the issue with all of those reporting mechanisms is they're either not anonymous or not enabling a two-way conversation. Mm-hmm. So you may have picked up my lovely French accent, and I'm a Frozy, so French Australian. I've lived in Australia for 13 years, but at the time, you know, I still had my French accent, and I thought if I call the hotline, they're going to pick up my accent fairly quickly. And there's only a bunch of proggies in that company, so they're going to identify me fairly quickly. Also, if I call someone, I can't send them any evidence. So all of those 308 invoices, I couldn't send to the phone. You don't know who you're speaking to, and it's quite scary because they're not from your company, so they don't necessarily understand your organization and what you found. Then the fax, never used the fax in my entire life, so I didn't choose that option. The email address, they could have picked up my IP address, even though I may have, you know, created a fake Gmail or Yahoo Mail account. And the mail, the PO box, was the last resort. And I thought maybe someone already sent something and you don't know who actually is going to pick it up. You don't know if anyone's going to pick it up at the other end. And there's no two-way conversation. So none of those systems actually worked for me. So the only option I was left with was to speak up to someone. And I chose my manager. The reason why I did that was because she was new. She'd been there for 2 months only. 5 months. I was there for 2 months. And I trusted that person. And so I just went in casually into her office and showed a bunch of invoices. And after a few minutes, she went up to the office of the CEO, and that's how the whole thing blew up.
Wow. And what happened next? You're still at Leighton Contractors. You've uncovered a fraud. Well, once you've done that, then what happens?
So the company definitely did the right thing because I kept my job, which is fairly unusual when you're a whistleblower, and actually gave me a promotion. They didn't give me a pay rise, and I'll insist on that because whistleblowers aren't in it for the money, at least the real one. And they gave me a promotion in the sense that they wanted me to sniff around and see if there was anything else happening in the organization. As per the fraudster, he coped 12 years behind bars. So that was also something big for me in the sense that I was the guy, or the analogy was, I was the guy holding the gun and had the power to kind of pull the trigger. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing about being a whistleblower. It's really, really hard to actually, you might think that you know something is wrong, but you know that the consequences of your action may destroy someone else's life. And so it was kind of a tough time for me personally to know that I was putting someone behind bars if I was to come up and report the wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. But in hindsight, you know, he was fully conscious about his actions, and he knew what he was doing, and he was kind of relieved when we stopped him because he couldn't stop himself. So I ended up being as a risk manager slash investigators for a couple of years at Leighton. And that really led me to the idea of Wispy, because as I was looking around, I realized that a lot of people could see or suspect that misconduct and wrongdoing was happening, and none of them felt comfortable in speaking up, even though we had access to all those, you know, external reporting mechanisms.
Why do you think that whistleblowers often get such a hard time, even though they're exposing things that are wrong? They're doing the right thing by speaking up about things that are wrong. Why do they often then get punished for that?
I think it's partly because of our culture, mostly in Australia. We don't dump it onto our mates. I think I look at it very differently. I look at it as having people that commit wrongdoing or misconduct has an impact on an organization and its people. And a clear example of that at Leighton was employee morale and employee productivity was going down. While we had some really great people there, but they could see what was happening. And because they didn't feel comfortable in speaking up, their mental health was impacted. And I think that's when we have a moral duty to actually, stand up and tell things as they are. But unfortunately, there was not, at least before Wispy, a system that was allowing people to speak up with that fear. The most important is being able to take the fear away from people, so that you are on the same level playing field with the organization, and they can, report something or suspicion of misconduct and wrongdoing without having to think, what is going to be the answer from the company? Am I going to lose my job, or am I going to lose the next promotion? Am I right or am I wrong? Because some whistleblowers aren't correct. Sometimes you only see a narrow part of the problem, and you would like to get confirmation. And most people will not ask the question whether this is right or wrong because of that fear of not knowing what the response from the company is going to be like.
Mm-hmm. When did you decide to leave Leighton's and actually start Wispy? How long after that episode did that happen?
It was 2.5 years after I uncovered the fraud, and it really came up as I realized that in any organization, our best asset are our people, and we're just preventing them from speaking up. And so I thought, but if only we could make them anonymous, then they would be able to reach out to the company, get some feedback, and things will get better, not only for the informant, but also for the organization, because in many cases, I was missing leads from people. I was missing information from people. So so I thought about, maybe by creating a secure, anonymous two-way communication platform, we could kind of solve that problem. And so I went into the office of the head of internal audit at Leighton Holdings at the time and told him what I was thinking about doing. And the guy said, this is a great idea. And so I resigned on the spot and then rang my wife to tell her that I was starting a new company. And the next 2 days were not the best in my life, but things got better over time.
Okay. And so at what point did you decide you were going to take Wispy global and turn it into something that went beyond that problem that you'd encountered at Leighton's? Was there a specific event that prompted it, or a decision point, or was it just woven into the design of the company from the start?
I think the thing is, even though we're a B2B platform, it's being used by employees and students. And if you take an organization, a lot of them are global anyway. And when they're looking for a whistleblowing platform, they'll be looking for a platform that can address all of the market that they operate into. And so very early on, we had the requirements from our clients that Wispy could be used in different languages. And it has never been a problem, at least in the beginning, because to translate information on a reporting form is not rocket science. And so we started that way. And then things got more complicated as we realized that a lot of our clients actually were located overseas. So, translating the platform for your Australian-based client that have a bunch of countries where they've got people that speak a different language is very easy. But when more and more of your clients are actually located overseas, it's a whole different ballgame. And I think this happened for different reasons. One, I hold two passports. I'm a Frozy, so I've got a French and an Austrian passport. And so I spent the first 27 years of my life in Europe, and I've got strong tie in that part of the world. There's whistleblowing legislation that are popping up in France and now throughout Europe. And that led me to actually find new customers in those geographies. So I'd say very early on, we could see the suction from Australia into the US and into Europe, thanks to where the clients were located and where the demand is.
If you're enjoying the Business Beyond Borders podcast and you're thinking about expanding your company internationally, check out the Dearen & Associates website, dearenassociates.com. When you were choosing what markets to go to, was that organic? Was it just a function of where people were requesting help, or was there something else driving it?
No, it was definitely, so I'd say the main driver was legislation. Wherever you've got a whistleblowing legislation, there's demand. And usually those legislation will be fairly similar and will require that any company with more than 50 employees has a whistleblowing policy and adequate reporting mechanisms. And usually that's what's driving the demand for Whistly. Now there's countries where there's whistleblowing legislation and we don't necessarily intend to have an office or a base there. We're just working remotely either from Australia or the US or France or the UK where we've got people working from.
How soon into the journey did you start having clients from offshore?
So I'd say in the first 6 months, we started to have demand from clients based offshore. And that was, it's funny, that has never been kind of a problem or even a question. We never really knew that we would have people on the ground, in different countries that early. But I guess that was also driven by customer demand. And also the fact that when you look after customers that are in different time zones, it becomes really difficult to do it all from Australia.
Mm-hmm. Just thinking about this question of when you should go global, do you think that there is a right time for a company to expand outside its home jurisdiction? Because there are a couple of views on it. The traditional one is you need to saturate your home market or get very, very significant traction and penetration at home before you look offshore. But it seems like, especially in the SaaS world, there is an emerging view that you might do better if you start to go into other markets really, really early in the game. Have you got a view on that from your experience?
I'm not going to tell other entrepreneurs how to suck eggs, but I think for me, it's like Australia is a great country and you can do a lot just in Australia alone. And it's great to actually be in Australia because you can adjust and improve on what you, and iterate on everything that you're building. So I guess the difference with Whistly is we had to be global because our companies, our clients were kind of global anyway, whether they're employees or suppliers. And so it required that, having that translation piece in it. But I'd say the later, the better, because there's already so much to do in Australia. And yes, we all think that our business is going to be huge, within 2 or 3 years, but, we're all building a company and that takes years anyway. So, start from where you're comfortable and that's Australia, and stick to it for as long as you can. Yes, if there's a threat elsewhere, whether it's competition or there's demand, I'd say that's maybe the time now to look into it. But I guess, if all of our clients had been in Australia, we'd still be just an Australian company and not even contemplating going overseas because there's already a lot to do in that country. Now, yes, true that being a SaaS platform, you build everything to be available globally. And we took that opportunity, and being an entrepreneur, you want your solution to be everywhere anyway. So again, if I had to do it again, I'll do it all the same. I would go very early overseas because it was tempting and it was challenging. And I knew I could do it because I had kind of, lived 26 or 27 years in Europe, and I knew that region really well. So I was comfortable going in there as well. I think the people aspect is really important.
You've got a couple of languages under your belt and you've lived in a bunch of places. So you're obviously pretty well versed in how to work cross-culturally, but what kind of linguistic and cultural challenges did your team grapple with as you went into new markets with Whistly?
Definitely the language. I always thought that it was not fair that as a French citizen I had to learn English while I was at school. And now I reap the reward because I know how extremely valuable it is to speak more than one language. And so when I went to France, we didn't have that barrier of the language. And I think it would have been very different if I had to go to my own country only speaking English. So the language was definitely key. And that's why I'm thinking, you know, wherever you go, make sure that you go in there with the right people alongside you. At Wisply, we've got, I think, 11 different nationalities and pretty much the same languages. So we can kind of use that to our strength. But I guess the language is the first thing. And yes, you know, one could say it's easy to deal in English in any country or every country. Yes, it's kind of easier, but it's even better if you can speak their language and you understand their culture. It's still a people-to-people relationship, and we can see that with most of our clients. They buy Wisply, yes, for the tech for sure, but also for who is behind the company. So the interaction with the people is extremely important.
Is there anywhere that the cultural differences have been particularly challenging?
I don't think it has been challenging in any geographies where we operate right now. I do know that in some countries, I will definitely go first if it's a French-speaking country, that's for sure. So we kind of put some rules in place where we make it easy not to add barriers in front of us. So definitely the first one is the language. But I'd say most of the countries that we operate are used to deal with international suppliers or providers. And I can definitely say that Australia is out there in terms of exciting country or companies to do business with. So whether it's in the US or throughout Europe, whenever you say that you're from Australia, it's like you've got a brownie point.
Why is that?
I think it's like, for me, when I went to Australia for the first time in 2005, it was like going to the moon. You know, it's the place that you think you're never going to get to. And you only see it on TV or in books. And I guess for people, it's part of being part of that experience and living the dream. So I think Australians are really fortunate. Not only we've got super smart people and really great ideas, but people do like Australians. And I think we should definitely use that into our favor. Koalas.
That's a cool point. Just language and culture aside, what do you think has been the biggest challenge that you've faced as you've expanded into new geographies?
Oh, I think the first bit would be the admin burden, whether it's in the US or in Europe, whenever you think that you're actually going to go. And so when I say going to go, is physically set up an entity or whether it's a branch or a subsidiary, that's when things get more complicated. So in the early days, we only worked remotely out of Sydney, and then about 12 or 15 months ago, we decided to open a subsidiary in the US. And that's when you get into, okay, you did that in Australia, and it's like running one company. Now you're actually running two because you've got the same in the US, and now we're running a third one because we've got one in Paris, and we're opening a branch in London. And so every time you do that, you add complexity and admin burden onto yourself. So I'd say if your clients aren't requiring you to be physically in country, then do everything remotely is definitely a good option, because that will avoid all of the admin burden. But in our case, it was driven by the fact that whatever goes into Wisply is fairly sensitive. So having the servers in countries and a company that's actually in the country or in the Eurozone is very important to some of our government clients, where they want to deal with a European legal entity and not necessarily an Australian one. Also, I mentioned the fact that to look after your customers, it's harder to do when you're based in Australia and you've got a huge time difference between Europe and Australia. So it was okay in the early days, and I was fine to do calls at 1 a.m. in the morning. Now it's not fun anymore. So we decided to build a team on the other side of the planet.
Is that the answer, do you think, to managing the complexity in a situation where you've got to have multiple offices? Is putting a team in country the best way to manage the complexity, or are there other things that you could also do?
I guess some outsource part of the function, some do it all remotely. For us, it's important that relationship with the clients on top of the tech is what makes us win. We know that we're actually winning customers because we're good at looking after our clients and that we've got good tech. And so this is part of our service. Yes, we could do it all remotely, but we begin facing the customers every now and again, and also to be in a fairly close time zone, so we can be really reactive whenever they've got a question or a problem.
Yeah. What do you wish you'd known at the start of the journey?
That it would take so long to actually build a business. I don't think I'll do it again, but it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. So I think I'll do it all again if it was for Wispy, because this one is really close to my heart, I guess. It's not just a, business. I'm always saying I'm on a mission. So it's not a job. It's a mission, and it's a good one. There's a, we're not ready to stop, but it is really, really hard, and it takes a lot of time to build something.
What kind of transformations has going global and opening offices around the world created for the company and for the clients?
I think for us, it's the complexity. It's making sure that we've got some systems in place. So as all startup, we bootstrap for months, and so you don't spend any dollar on anything that's kind of a luxury. And so anything that's around that is not really in direct contact with your clients, or that is not for us in terms of we spend a lot of money in IT security, but anything else that is back office related, we're not spending a dollar on it, because we wanted that dollar to go to our clients or to our platform or to IT security. And that's fine in the early days, but as you grow and as you get more clients, it becomes a lot more complex, mostly when you're global. And so I'd say, we definitely had to catch up on putting some processes and systems in place to be able to scale, because otherwise we would have, would have been stuck and would have plateaued. So it was time, a few months ago to actually put things in place so we would be ready to scale Wispy. And that was definitely a big missing part.
And so then what's been the proudest moment for you so far on the journey?
I think it's the fact that we're doing something good for people, and for people, not only our clients and their employees and the organizations, but also if I look at me as an entrepreneur, I'm looking after people that have families, and that I'm super proud of. I know that, these guys rely on the living they're making out of Wispy. So we build a real business, a business that, is generating revenue. And this is to do good for not only our people internally, but also our customers and their own employees. To know that some students in some schools or college or universities, or employees in organizations, or employees in government agencies can use Wispy and have what we call trusted conversations to either get feedback or report misconduct and wrongdoing, help themselves in terms of making sure that if they're close to the burnout, they can reach out to someone anonymously, they can have a conversation, and they can get the support they deserve is super rewarding.
And for people who are listening to this show and they're wondering whether they should have a go at expanding their company internationally, what would you say?
I say, of course, do it. But I say, make sure you're ready to actually do it, and don't do it too quickly either, because it can be overwhelming. Even though I don't think it can come really quickly, but anyway, we didn't get all of those clients in a day. But I think yes, it's a real good challenge. Just make sure you're surrounded by people that can help you. Whether it's from a legal standpoint or tax or and making sure you've got the right structure and most important the right people to help you get there. So if you don't have the skills yourself, just be surrounded by people that do have those skills, whether in your office in Australia or wherever you might be, and that can help you also on the ground where you've got your new clients. Some businesses, however, are all online and don't require as much support as Wispy, for instance. So for them, it might be a lot easier. But I think if you've got a client-facing business that requires a lot of support, then make sure that you're ready before you actually do it. Otherwise, it can kind of damage your reputation and set you back for some pretty rough times.
That's some great advice. Sylvan, it's been heaps of fun having you on the show today. Thanks so much for coming along and sharing your story.
Thanks, Cynthia. No problem.
If you're enjoying the Business Beyond Borders podcast and you're thinking about expanding your company internationally, check out the Dearen & Associates website, dearenassociates.com. Our consulting services, which include market research and modeling, cross-cultural consulting, and strategic business connections, deliver deep insights and create value for larger companies looking to scale internationally. If you're from a smaller organization that wants to expand its global footprint, take a look at our International Business Accelerator program, which my team and I created to help micro to medium-sized businesses to speed up and de-risk the process of going global. The program helps business owners to build a great strategy without having to reinvent the wheel. It creates the momentum to put the strategy into play, and it helps them to generate or raise the funds that they need to get an international expansion off the ground. We built it especially for founders and CEOs who want to take their business to the next level and wondering where to start. It's structured in a way that's simple to follow. It's digital so that you can take part from anywhere in the world. It's a lot of fun and our members love it. Check it out at dearenassociates.com.